2012, January 23rd. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 13. What is life? Now, this week is going to look an awful lot not like an astronomy class, because we're going to be talking mostly about biology and the nature of life. This is kind of a fun section for me to do, because this is probably where I learned the most. I had to catch up on a lot of biology that I'd missed since my last serious biology class was actually in high school. I didn't have to take any, or didn't take any, biology and biochemistry when I was an undergraduate at Caltech. I kind of regret not doing that, although it turns out that what I would have learned there, I would have had to relearn, because there's been just a true revolution in biology over the last 10, 20 years. And our approach is not going to be to review Biology 101 so much as to set the stage for trying to understand if we want to look for life somewhere else. Often what we're doing is looking for places which have the conditions that are conducive to life, and in order to understand that, we have to know something about life itself. What constitutes a living thing? And so we're going to go through a series of lectures that are going to basically take the highlights of modern biology, but do that with this goal of trying to understand what the nature of life on Earth is, so we can begin to sensibly ask this question somewhere else. And today I want to pick up a question which is very abstract in many ways, but also very difficult, which is to ask the question of what is the biological definition of life? There's lots and lots of definitions around what living things are and might be. There's all kinds of philosophical descriptions. Of course, there are religious views, there are social views, but I want to look at what does a biologist do when they try to assess is something living or not living. And what we're going to see, what it really boils down to, is that there are six characteristics that are common to all living organisms. So in a way, we're not going to answer the question posed today, what is life, but we're going to give you an idea of how that question is framed. We're going to see that these six common characteristics are that all life has order or structure, that it has an ability to reproduce, that it has an ability to grow and develop, that all forms of life utilize energy from their environments in different ways. This can be very important to us to assessing conditions on a planetary surface for life. That living things respond to their environments. And finally, that they evolve in order to adapt to their environments. So all six of these properties are important characteristics of life, but which ones are going to be more important for coming up with a working definition of life, even if we don't have the final answer, at least have a good working definition that leads us forward. So the big question in biology, one of the major questions in biology, is how you distinguish something that is living from non-living. So for example, I have two examples here of a living and a non-living thing. I have Gus over here on the left, who is often in this state in various configurations, and on the right I have Hello Kitty, a cultural icon. Now we would all sort of agree that while Gus is zonked out pretty badly here, Hello Kitty is the non-living entity in this particular thing, and Gus, however zonked he is in fact living, especially around dinner time. That's an obvious one. But sometimes the line between living and non-living is not so obvious. For example, on the left I have an Ebola virus. And on the right, I have E. coli. A lot of biologists would argue that viruses are not living in the normals in the same sense that E. coli are living. And in fact, some biologists go so far as to say that viruses, in fact, are not exactly living creatures. They land on kind of this border between living and non-living. They have some of the characteristics of living beings, but not all of them in the same way that E. coli do. So the distinction of the line between living and non-living, well, between Gus and Hello Kitty is pretty obvious. It's not always as clear, and often this is where a lot of modern research is occurring. So biologists can break the problem down, and they recognize that there are six basic properties that are shared by all forms of life on Earth. And all of these have to do with how life functions and how life interacts with both other living things and with their environment. And in general, what one can consider the environment are the other living things in the environment. And we're going to go through these one by one. But they are that all living things have order or structure to them, that they all have the capability to reproduce, that they grow and develop, that they utilize energy, they respond to the environment, and that they have a property known as evolutionary adaptation. They change in response to their environment in ways that accrue through multiple generations and ultimately lead to new species. So let's walk through these one after another and look at how these impact on the question of what is life. Let's start with this idea of order. if we look deep inside of living things, from the simplest living things like bacteria and single-celled organisms to very complex beings like ourselves, what we find is order. There's order and structure. The molecules making up living things are not just simply randomly in a bag. They actually have formed coherent patterns, and they form coherent structures that are often repeated from organism to organism in outline, if not perhaps in detail. All living organisms actually on Earth resemble all other living organisms. They share a lot of common structures. Differences of those structures are how we actually begin to distinguish one type of organism from another. So, for example, on the left, I have a small bacterium here, which has a very interesting ordered structure to it. And on the right-hand side, I have another system that has order, but no one would argue is living. That's a snowflake. So again, this is part of this, what we're going to be contrasting in here, is while I'm going to find a characteristic that is essential to life, I can almost always find a non-living example. This is an example of what we refer to as a necessary but not sufficient condition. It is necessary for life to be ordered, but having order does not make you living. This is why the problem gets to be very difficult. We're dealing with conditions which turn out to be necessary but not sufficient conditions. So order is essential. You're not just simply a bag of parts. You're an ordered bag of parts that have a coherent structure to them. And we'll elucidate what some of that structure is in future lectures. The second characteristic that all living beings on Earth share is that they're capable of making copies of themselves, of reproducing. The methods of reproduction can be either asexual reproduction, where you simply split off into two copies of each of yourself, or you sexually reproduce, where you have two organisms come together, share exactly half of a genome, and the result is a third creature, which is an amalgam hybrid of the other two, at least genetically speaking. Obviously, it's kind of a strange thing to think about it, but a child, a human child, is in some sense a hybrid of the mother and father. Each, it has half of the genetic material of the mother and the father, making up this third new entity which shares traits from both. Like there's dominant traits and recessive traits. There's a lot of detail. Again, this idea of reproduction is a necessary condition, but it is not a sufficient condition. Okay, for example, not every living being is actually capable of reproducing. There are sterile forms. The difference between donkeys and mules, for example. And I always forget which one is which, so I'm not going to try that one out on you today because I always forget. But basically, there are hybrid forms of life which themselves cannot reproduce. They are sterile. Similarly, there are non-living entities that can actually reproduce themselves. Computer viruses are a very good example of that. In fact, their name, computer virus, somewhat resembles they resemble viruses biologically in many ways. They can make copies of themselves. They can, like internet worms, internet viruses can quickly replicate themselves through millions of computers through the internet. But no one would argue that a computer virus is actually living. It makes a copy of itself, but it's not a living entity. It's only sort of a simulacrum of life by mimicking this one particular characteristic. So reproduction is very important, but again, it's a necessary condition. All forms of life we think must be, but it's a somewhat softer necessary condition. We can identify forms of life that do not reproduce by themselves. This turns out to be important and looking at one of the boundaries between living and non-living. For example, viruses and proteins are borderline cases because they do not carry their own reproductive machinery with them. For example, a virus like Ebola cannot reproduce on its own. If you had a bag full of viruses, you would not end up with a bigger bag of viruses later because they're reproducing. Viruses reproduce because they infect living cells and then hijack that cell's reproductive machinery to make copies of themselves. Most of you have seen me going through various evolutions of a couple of different viral infections through the course of this class as I fought off both a chest cold and then recently a head cold. Those cold viruses cannot reproduce by themselves out in the environment. They have to invade the cells in my body and use various cells in my throat, head, and nose to reproduce themselves. They hijack the cellular machinery. That's one of the reasons why people think viruses live kind of on that borderline. They're a different kind of life, or there may be a kind of proto-life. Maybe they represent a kind of a early version of what life may have been like on the Earth, but no one's really sure. They don't have DNA. A few viruses do. There's always exceptions. That's why biology is so damned hard. But Viruses primarily contain RNA. And we'll learn later why RNA is important. Another, perhaps less ambiguous case are what are called prions, or prions are sometimes reproduced. Prions are infectious proteins inside of cells. They replicate probably not by actually making copies of themselves so much as forcing normal proteins to fold up abnormally and therefore become these abnormal systems. If you will, they influence other proteins to become abnormal. Example of prions, for example, are in these mouse cells. Mad cow disease is an example of a prion-based disease. These weirdly twisted proteins get into your brain cells. They cause other proteins in your brain cells to twist up into a bad fold. That bad fold disrupts cellular function, and that's the cause of the disease. But the prions themselves contain no genetic information. They're proteins, and they cannot replicate by themselves. They simply hijack the biochemical machinery of the host cells to make other copies of themselves or, in effect, copy themselves. So these things are forms of reproduction, but they're not intrinsic to the body. And that's one of the reasons why things like viruses and prions are so interesting to study, because they stand on that shadowy boundary between living and non-living things. All right. Property number three. Once you make a copy of yourself, that copy will grow and develop. All living organisms can increase in mass, and as they develop, in many ways, can increase capabilities. So, for example, the sperm and egg that get together to form the miniature alligator, this alligator is going to grow to a bigger alligator and eventually reach the point where it's mature and can make other alligators, at least in concert with another alligator. Sometimes the changes are much more dramatic, like the life cycle of a butterfly through the caterpillar phase. These are all examples of where the development of the life, there is a clear distinction between birth, life, and ultimately death. There's a cycle that's going on, or maybe at least a one-ended pathway here. But they grow and develop. They don't just simply pop out. Even bacteria grow and develop. It may not seem that way, but in fact, bacteria go through a life cycle. And that life cycle usually terminates when they reproduce, when they split up into two smaller bacteria. But they still show signs of development. The original form, early form of a bacterium, is very different than the late form that ultimately reproduces. Now again, all living organisms that we see grow and develop in various ways. Viruses and prions do not grow, do not develop. They simply induce copies of themselves. But they don't develop. Once you're a virus, always a virus. However, not everything that grows is living. So, for example, inside of deepened caves, you can have growth and change of form through geological processes or chemical processes. So growth and development, an unfolding over time, is a common property of many physical systems. The difference is what guides that process. And as we're going to see, this is guided by sort of the physics and chemistry of the surrounding environment, whereas the growth and development of living organisms is mediated by cell function within the organisms themselves. They guide their own growth and development. It isn't just simply a consequence of the environment that you're in. So we do have to distinguish again between what we mean by growth and development more specifically. Again, and once again, this is what makes answering the question of what is life so difficult, is we're faced with necessary but not sufficient conditions. Just because you grow and develop does not make you living. Now, the control of this growth turns out to be controlled through the machinery of heredity, through your DNA. The DNA contains the instructions for cell function. As we'll see in a later lecture, it's the RNA that implement or carry out those instructions for cell function. But it's the same material. The thing that determines that you're an alligator or a butterfly is in your deep genetic DNA structure, but then that DNA sets up the cell functions for the individual pieces, whether you're a bacterium, an alligator, or a person. The fourth property of life that turns out to be important, and we're going to be seeing more of this when we talk in more detail about life later in this week, is energy utilization. All forms of life are energy consumers. They need energy to grow, develop, and reproduce. You lose energy or you have no source of energy, the system simply runs down before it can grow, develop, or reproduce. And a form of life that doesn't reproduce is pretty damned useless after one generation. It goes away. So it turns out that we often refer to this idea of using energy drawn from the environment is often generally referred to as metabolism. You somehow get energy from your surroundings, and that's how you power cell function. So for example, photosynthesis. Plants like the palm tree here get their energy from sunlight to convert water and carbon dioxide into simple sugars and oxygen. Those simple sugars are what power the cell function of all photosynthetic life on the planet, whether it's single cellular or complex things like a palm tree. Other types of creatures get their energy not from sunlight, but from other creatures, from chemicals that they ingest, primarily ingestion of carbon chemicals. We are carbon-based life. Our chemistry is based on carbon. So in fact, most of metabolism on the Earth is concerned with the uptake and utilization of carbon, which takes energy. Sunlight and photosynthesis, eating other carbon, in the case of, oh, say, the pride of lions here surrounding a kill. They can hang out in the sun all day, and although it seems like, in fact, cats are photosynthetic, they're not, as you can tell as soon as you open a can of tuna, because they're after the chemicals, the carbon and the proteins inside the animal meat is what gives them their life. But again, we're faced with another necessary but sufficient condition. Windmills get their function and power their function by wind. They tap into energy sources, in this case kinetic energy of wind, in their environment to provide for their function. A solar panel is not a photosynthetic device, but it does use sunlight to convert into electricity. They function by gathering energy from their surroundings, but they are not living. So we can identify non-living things that rely on external energy sources to function, but that itself alone is not sufficient to explain its being alive. So this idea of a source of metabolism we're going to pick up later, because that's actually fairly important. It's a form of interacting with your environment. Do you interact with light in your environment? Do you interact with sources of carbon in your environment? Do you interact with sources of heat in your environment? Whether your environment provides those or not determines what kind of life, what kind of metabolism you're going to develop. For example, there are forms of metabolism that require purely on carbon and chemicals. There are those like our metabolism, human metabolism, requires on oxygen. We could not exist if the Earth did not have an oxygen atmosphere. So this is an aspect of interaction with one's environment, but how one gets energy to power cell function. It's kind of silly to think about it, but lunch is basically a requirement that you are powering your cell functions. Property number five, sort of leading into this, is response to your environment. All living organisms that we know of sense and react to their environments. They may sense it. Usually we sense our environment chemically, although we happen to possess a couple of other ways of interacting with our environment. So I can smell the environment, but I also have a sense of touch, I have a sense of sight, I have a sense of smell. Probably have left one out there, which probably doesn't matter much in this particular case. Response to changes. We can also respond to changes in temperature. Our bodies certainly respond to changes in temperature. Often plants respond to changes in temperature. The life cycle of plants is driven by a combination of sunlight and exterior temperature. Why trees don't have leaves during the wintertime. Why bulbs die at the end of the season, but when the ground gets warmer and the days get longer, all of a sudden we're going to see towards the end of this quarter things, hopefully green things, popping up out of the ground. They're responding to changes in their environment. It might be changes in temperature. It might be changes in sunlight. It might be changes in the chemical environment surrounding us. For example, certain microbiological forms of life will respond to their chemical environment. They might move from one place to another because that chemical environment is how they work their metabolism. In fact, the usual thing we mean by response is that the thing moves. So, for example, in response to sounds or something, the meerkats stand up. And they look around. They respond to their environment. Plants sense the light environment. They also sense gravity. So, for example, plants know to grow upwards against gravity, but many plants are what are called phototropic. I put the light source off to the side, the plants grow to the side. They actually are responding to the light, and they're changing their structure, literally moving, although very, very slowly, in response to their environment. But once again, we see that this is a necessary, but it's not a sufficient condition. A thermostat is an example of something that responds to the environment. It's a mechanical device, electronic device, that responds to changes in temperature, and in fact can push back upon the environment itself. It's no one would ever think their thermostat is living. I sometimes think my thermostat in my home has a mind of its own, but it's not actually living. It's just simply malfunctioning. Whereas these creatures all have a sensing of their environment. It can be response to temperature, chemical, sunlight, all of the different things in their environment. It produces a response. You change the response, the animal responds to it in kind. Finally, all living creatures we know of on Earth share the same property of being evolutionarily adaptable. They show signs of evolutionary adaptation. They evolve in order to better adapt to their environments. Their environments can mean the chemical, temperature, overall, you know, general wind, cold, etc. environment, or environment can mean pressures from other organisms or other things coming in from the outside. For example, if you look very carefully at this picture here on the left, this is an evolutionary adaptation in the pygmy seahorse, which lives among coral. Some of the pygmy seahorses have begun to change their head, a mutation that caused their external coloration to better match that of coral. After a while, they don't get eaten as often, so they survive to subsequent generations. It's a very common form of adaptation, although it's a simple one. But one should point out that one has to be very careful about how one deals with adaptations. They do not accrue to individuals. Well, yes, I can adapt to my environment by putting on a jacket or building a warmer house. But that's not an evolutionary adaptation. That's just an immediate change of configuration to adapt to changes in environment. An adaptation that I'm talking about are ones that accrue not to individuals but to populations and build up over many, many generations. These are things that happen slowly over long periods of time. In particular, if adaptations are significant enough, they can lead to something called speciation. You actually have a splitting between living organisms so that an entirely new type or new variation, a new species of that organism, suddenly comes into play. These can be very slow or very gradual, or they can be due to extreme changes in environment where only a handful of particularly mutated groups survive in that area. And after very long periods of time and accruing of these changes of evolutionary adaptations, you eventually end up with a completely new species. In the next valley over, maybe your have a common ancestor with those species, but you can no longer interbreed. In fact, you may not even be able to live in each other's environments. So evolutionary adaptation turns out to be an extremely important one for understanding the nature of life. In fact, it's going to turn out to be one of the key properties that we're going to identify, so I want to spend some time talking about it. The idea that life can adapt to itself in an evolutionary way is very old. Now let me define some language here. When I say the word evolution, I mean it in the sense that it has always been meant. Evolution is an unfolding. How things change over time. We can apply it to biological systems. We can apply it to physical systems. We can apply it to cultures. All evolution is simply the recognition that things change. It's how things unfold. The question is not whether things evolve or not, but the means by which that evolution is driven. In the case of a star, we talk about stellar evolution. The life cycle of stars from the beginning of their existence to their end is driven by the physical properties of gases and nuclear physics in their cores. In biological systems, it's a lot more complicated. And people began to notice that there was evolution among forms. We've seen these people before. Anaximander, who we remember was one of the early ideas that you know, the stars were physical systems, also dealt with life. He came up with the idea that life, in fact, arose in water. Water is, in fact, a much more heavily populated environment than the land. And so he got the idea that water life, marine life being very abundant and diverse, first developed in the water and then developed somehow, he didn't say how, into more complex forms that eventually populated the land. He was very much ahead of himself, but he was making a basic observation of the world around him. Aristotle, much like the case between Anaximander and Aristotle in talking about astronomy, viewed the world as fixed and unchanging except on the Earth. And he said that even on Earth, species are fixed and unchanging. Elephants are elephants and always were elephants, for example. So Aristotle shut down this whole idea that life could even evolve at all, that it could change, that you could have new species, or that those species could change over time. So Aristotle was, if you will, a kind of an ultimate anti-evolutionist. But the view does not actually accord with the observations of the natural world. We see evidence of species that have existed in the past that do not exist in the present. The possibility of extinction comes into play. We've driven more than a few species to extinction, even in our own lifetimes. So it's very clear that species in the past, we see evidence that there were life forms in the past that do not exist in the present. Similarly, we find present-day life forms that do not exist in the fossil record. We go back far enough, we don't see things that look like us or things that we see around us. And this was well noticed and certainly observed into the 18th and 19th centuries. And one of the ideas that came forward was by a man by the name of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. He was working on the ideas of heredity, and he thought that, in fact, traits that are acquired by organisms are passed on to their offspring. If I develop something, if I develop some characteristic, I will pass that characteristic along. He had no idea what the mechanisms of heredity were, and he was just making a guess. Well, it turns out that both Aristotle and Lamarck are dead wrong. That traits acquired during lifetime, things you learn, you know, things that happen to you. If you lose a hand, if I lose my hand in an accident, my children do not grow up one-handed. They are not born one-handed. So that's a trait which I've acquired. It isn't passed on. And Lamarck had to kind of do some quick dancing and say why some traits are acquired and some not. This is a real wrong direction here. It basically doesn't understand the role of heredity in passing along traits. Aristotle was simply wrong because, in fact, it flew in the face of observations of the natural world. The natural world is constantly in flux. New species are, in fact, constantly coming into play, whether they're coming through the active activities of man and, for example, selective breeding programs, which even the Greeks knew how to selectively breed horses and plants. So Aristotle was simply ignoring basic practices of agriculture. You can bring new species into being by selective breeding over many, many generations. We do it all the time, as I'll show some examples. So what is the mechanism by which you have change passed on through populations? And the answer turns out to be, at least we certainly have very strong opinions that it is this case, is this idea there's a process referred to as natural selection. Natural selection, of course, is the idea that was put forward by Charles Darwin in the 19th century in the book On the Origin of Species, published first in 1859. Darwin got his ideas by studies of the natural world mainly on a voyage he took around the world as a young man, shown on the left here, on board the HMS Beagle. He was able to observe many different forms of life, many different transitory forms, collected fossils, but he also came across the Galapagos Islands, where extreme evolutionary pressure, extreme environmental pressure, had led to very significant and very obvious speciation events during the recent past. And you could see the differences of the different species he found in Galapagos. And putting all these ideas together, all the things that were going on in natural sciences through the 19th century, he took an amazing leap, conceptual leap, and understood this idea of natural selection. This is often referred to as evolution full stop. Evolution is the, I will be very clear about evolution. We're going to take evolution as an assumption of correctness in this class. The reason is that without a principle of evolution, namely through the mechanism of natural selection, all of modern biology simply cannot be understood. It is the core principle around which modern biology is built. This is not a class about evolutionary biology, but at least a basic idea of where it comes from should be known. Evolution is, unfortunately, also probably one of the most willfully misunderstood ideas in modern times. It is a very important principle and is important to us in understanding life on other worlds. Natural selection is the mechanism, is the means by which evolution occurs in living systems. Natural selection is basically based upon what Darwin called two undeniable facts leading to an inescapable conclusion. The first fact is this, sort of a Malthusian idea from a man by the name of Malthus studying populations of people, that any population can produce more offspring than the local environment can support. That's an obvious thing. If you turn rabbits loose into an environment where there are no predators for rabbits, oh, say like what happened in Australia when rabbits were introduced for food, busted out of their hutches and pretty much devastated the landscape because nothing could eat or ate rabbits normally, and they reproduced out of control. That led to then intense competition for resources, and they began to die back after the rabbits would move into a place and basically eat everything in sight, and the rabbits would begin to starve. So whenever you have any population turned loose, it will inevitably make more offspring than the local environment can support. That leads to competition for resources, competition for food. If you're a predator, it leads to competition for prey. If you're a vegetarian, it's competition for plant life and so forth. So again, that's sort of, in many ways, a statement of the obvious. You can make more things than you can support in a local environment. The second fact is that individual offspring vary in the traits that are passed on from their parents through this mechanism of heredity. We've already seen that. Peas that produce purple flowers will occasionally produce peas with white flowers. These are hereditary traits passed on through the agency of DNA. You don't have to understand DNA is present to understand the principles of heredity. We look like our biological parents, but I do not look exactly like my father. I may share certain small motor skills. It's very spooky, for example, to look in my father's college textbook and notice that our handwriting is, in fact, very similar to my handwriting when I was in college. A friend of mine shows me a very spooky video of his father walking. His father died long before, a couple months before he was born, and yet he walks just like my friend does. You know, inheritability of small motor skills. But he doesn't look anything like his father. His father was short and fat. He's a tall, skinny guy. He's got blue eyes. His father has brown eyes. He has red hair. His father had black hair. So we differ, but only in sort of small ways. There's always variation within a population. This variation is driven by sexual reproduction. I get half my instructions from my father, half my instructions from my mother. And that's true of every creature that lives on the earth that reproduces by sexual behavior. Single-celled organisms also vary, but they vary more slowly because they live by cell division. So there is a mechanism through heredity by which you introduce variation into the population. So those are the two basic facts. No one has any problem with that. The inescapable conclusion is that those individuals whose traits best adapt them to survive and reproduce will pass those favorable traits on to larger numbers of offspring. This leads naturally to this idea of selection of favorable traits. Now, this phrase has been distorted into survival of the fittest, or nature red in tooth and claw. This says nothing about absolute fitness. It says nothing about absolute superiority of one creature over another. In fact, it actually often works over small incremental advantages. For example, you might be a bird that eats a particular seed, and there aren't too many seed-bearing plants on the island that you live on. There's two different variations on this seed plant, those with little tiny soft-shelled seeds and those with really hard-shelled seeds. There are small variations in the strength of the beak of the bird. A heavy beak is required to break the heavy seeds. Otherwise, you can't eat them. But everybody can eat the small seeds. And now, we're going to introduce so they compete for resources, they reproduce, and you have these birds, finches, some with big beaks, some with small beaks. The big beak ones can eat the heavy seeds and the light seeds. The small beak ones can only eat the light seeds. And then we introduce a pressure on that environment. A virus comes through and kills off all the small seed plants on that island. What's going to happen? The beaks with the finches with the light beak don't have anything to eat anymore, and they die out. The finches with the big beaks can eat the small things, but they can eat the heavy seeds too, and they'll stay. So small variations, all of a sudden, you now selectively pick out those finches that are born with a heavy beak or a small beak is genetic variation. An offspring of a finch might be two heavy beak or one light beak. But if you put an evolutionary pressure such that the environment favors the heavy-beaked finch because they can survive, they can eat, and therefore survive long enough to reproduce, after a few generations, that island will only have heavy-beaked finches upon it, because the light-beaked finches cannot survive long enough to reproduce. They're siblings. They're genetically nearly identical, except for a little tickle on the tail that makes a difference between a heavy beak and a small beak. That's hardly survival of the fittest. It's just a tiny variation that produces just enough relative advantage to cause a sudden change in the finches on that particular island. And this selection of successful or favorable traits against the environment is a natural selection. It's simply driven by changes in the environment. There's a reason why I picked finches. In fact, it was the observation of finches that Darwin did on the Galapagos finches that was one of the main pieces of evidence for exactly this. The Galapagos are a series of islands off the Pacific coast of South America. All of the finches, the many different types of finches on the Galapagos Islands, are all descended from the common South American mainland finch. They got out there maybe by a storm or something like that. The Galapagos are fairly far away, but finches populated the place. But on different islands, you had finches that grew on the ground and finches that grew on islands with trees. You had finches that could eat bugs versus those that could eat insects, those that could eat cactus flowers versus those that could eat seeds. And depending upon what kind of seeds and different sizes, you suddenly had all kinds of variations appear, as in one particular environment, those finches that could live pretty well in trees eating insects got an advantage over bud eaters if there weren't many buds to eat on that particular island. Those that could eat on seeds where there weren't any trees had an advantage over the insect eaters, and eventually the population evolved so you only ended up with seed eaters. And then you started seeing further breakdowns between those islands that had plants with big, heavy seeds and those islands that had plants with light seeds. This was extremely obvious, and this happened fast. This is less than geologic time. And it was these key insights that gave Darwin the insight into this idea of the mechanism of natural selection. This and many other observations. If you ever read The Origin of Species, it's actually worth reading. It's really interestingly well written. You find that Darwin says absolutely nothing about human evolution in it whatsoever. That was a later book. He spends an awful lot of time talking about selective breeding, and he seems to have a thing for beetles and pigeons. But the basic insights are there. And what Darwin is struggling with is, what is the mechanism by which this selection occurs? What is the mechanism of heredity? Because Darwin didn't even know about the work of Gregor Mendel, nor did he understand DNA. That was a century in the future. But the basic outline of the mechanism is there. What differs is the underlying molecular implementation of natural selection, and that will come through the agency of DNA, through the mechanism of heredity. Now, natural selection is only a subset of a ways in which selection can be imposed upon a population to give rise to new species. Human beings have done this all the time that they began to domesticate plants and animals. It's called artificial selection. We can breed plants and animals for desired traits, in which we are acting as the agents of selection instead of environmental factors like whether, you know, your trees have buds on them or not that are edible. Here's a good example. Here are six different of those vegetables your mother always wanted you to eat. Broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, kale, and kohlrabi. I hate Brussels sprouts, but I love broccoli. They're all the same in some sense. They all derive from a common ancestor, the wild mustard. Wild mustard is actually pretty tasty. It's got tasty greens. You can chew on the seeds. You can collect the seeds and make a nice paste out of them and spread it on your ham sandwich. But as you breed them, you might notice that certain mustards have a little bit of a mutation which leads to fairly large, thick stems and fairly big flowers. And you say, you know, those taste better. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to grow a bunch of mustard, and when I see the ones that taste good, I'm going to tear up everything else and only breed those. A few generations down the line, I got broccoli. Another person came back and said, I don't want to eat the greens crap. I like the ones with the white flower heads. So you begin to selectively breed those out. Ooh, green ones. Yeah, pull those up. Throw those away. You go after the white ones. A couple generations later, you've got cauliflower. You look deep inside the DNA of these things. You can see all the common elements, but you've selected against the ones that have the tick for white pigmentation instead of green pigmentation. You've also selected against some other things, so they taste slightly different. But take a close look at the next time you pick up cauliflower and broccoli. Look really closely at them. They're very similar in structure. Cabbage is basically the terminal buds. You basically have those that have an unusually big terminal bud, and you throw the others away. Pretty soon, it's all bud. Other places, you could say, well, instead of having the terminal bud on the end of the stem being funky, I like these things with lateral buds on the side that are pretty good, and they got the big leaves. That's Brussels sprouts after a few generations. Or, I like the leaves, to hell with the flowers. You start breeding them for flowers, pretty soon you got kale. And somebody, somewhere along the line, there's a mutation that causes the stem to bulge up just above the ground in mustard. You look at that and go, oh, that's a sick plant, you'd yank it out. One day, someone ate that and went, hey, that's kind of spicy, I like that. So they started breeding for the ball, kohlrabi. Genetically, they're all derived from wild mustard. But human beings with different tastes in vegetables have developed six completely new species by selectively breeding the wild mustard. So that's human beings doing this over multiple generations. That same mechanism is at work, but it's not directed. That's the difference between artificial selection and natural selection. Natural selection is kind of what happens as the creature responds to its environment, changes in its environment, perhaps. Artificial selection is obviously being guided. Green flowers versus white flowers, broccoli versus kohlrabi, but many, many, many generations. After a while, you've separated so far from the original parent species, you kind of forget they're all related. We see these all as separate vegetables on our plate, but in fact, they all derive from a single parent through the actions of human beings applying artificial selection against the passing down of hereditary traits. We selected for hereditary traits we liked, green flowers, fat stems, and over time, they're the only ones left in that lineage, and they eventually speciated. So I can't crossbreed a kohlrabi with a broccoli. Or maybe I can and get something funky. Some of these things still, plants are a little bit more mutable than animals. Okay. We've looked at six characteristics for life. Order and structure. Utilization of energy. Ability to reproduce. Response to the environment. Growth and development. I got them out of order. And evolutionary adaptation in response to the environment. Of the two, it turns out the two of the six, two are turning out to be central. The other ones kind of come and go in importance, but two seem to pop up as being critically important to life. That is, the ability to reproduce. If you can't reproduce, you're kind of a useless form of life. There isn't going to be any other form of you afterwards. And the ability to evolve. Because if you don't evolve, if you don't have the ability to evolve, your genetic heritage is going to get wiped out the first time the environment changes in a bad way. And actually, sometimes that does happen. Ultimately, sometimes you tip the balance too hard. The throw of the dice just goes too far against you. Or rather, the big asteroid whacks your species on the head. But you have to have a way to pass on that genetic information and a way for that genetic information to adapt to the surroundings so you continue to live inside that environment. So this is going to give us a working definition of a living organism. A living organism is something that can reproduce and evolve to adapt to its environment. All the other traits are secondary traits, but these are the ones that are central. So, can an organism reproduce and can it evolve to adapt to its environment? We can look at a bacterium, a virus. A virus sits on the boundary between these. It reproduces, but not by itself, but it can evolve. The fact that I don't have, there's no such thing as a cold vaccine that keeps me from getting miserable every winter, the virus continually evolves because it gets, I build up adaptation to one, I build up a resistance to one, and it kills off all the viri except the ones that can ignore my antibodies, and that one survives. Boom. If you don't believe in the evolution of species, go out and try your hand at a meat-eating bacterium sometime, and they're bad news, right? We're constantly antibiotics driving the evolution of microbiological systems. We can drive it pretty easily. That's a form of artificial selection, right? We've killed off all the streptococci that respond to penicillin. Now we got to go to erythromycin and some really badass things to try to kill it off. What happens? We end up with a more badass bug bouncing out the back. It works. This is the mechanism. So with this basis, we're now going to say this is what constitutes life. We're now going to explore is what is the machinery of life? What is, in fact, the biochemical basis? How does life work? And how hard can we push the environment? How well is it adapted to its environment? And how extreme can that environment get? And that's where we're going for the rest of the week. Any questions? Okay, with that, just bring up the lights and we'll get your homeworks.